This is Harry Murray at Murray's Fly Shop in Edinburgh, Virginia. This is sort of our mid-March question and answer period. You've sent me some emails, you've called on questions. So I'm just going to hit some of the high spots on letters that you've sent me. Let's see, let's start off with, the hatches this spring. Somebody was saying that I had written something about how the aquatic insect hatches in the mountain streams often coincide the wildflowers, the bloodroot, the trillium, what that type thing. And there is a tremendous amount of overlap in this. For instance, when the bloodroot is blooming in the mountain stream, you get the Epis pluralis mayfly. Then a little later, when the trillium are pushing pretty hard, you get into the blue quail. So that's one way to sort of anticipate the hatches. If you don't want to get real heavy into entomology, you can go by that, because this does repeat itself year after year after year. And personally, I find it very interesting to see how it does repeat itself. Okay, now somebody was asking me, do I think it's important to carry a raincoat on the streams, either on the bass streams or in the mountain streams? Absolutely, I do. Some of us were floating a smallmouth river in the middle of the summer a couple years ago, and we were using little kickboats and canoes and kayaks and a little bit of everything. And I've forgotten how many there were of us. It was a pretty good crowd of people, but two of the people did not have raincoats. And it was warm in the summer. I'm talking about, probably 80 degrees. A storm came in. We all got soaked. Those that didn't have raincoats were just drenched. I offered my raincoat to one of the ladies, and she wouldn't take it. And when we got out of the stream that evening, she was shivering and shaking. And I've been caught flat-footed in these mountain streams. I always carry a raincoat if I'm going to be pretty far away from the car. I don't take a chance. Most of the raincoats are small enough now, you can stick them in the back of the vest. If you're floating the river, you can always have a drag bag with you. So I'm a firm believer in having a dry bag that'll have that. And speaking of dry bags, somebody asked me about that. What kind of change of clothes and stall that do I have in the car? I have a complete change of clothes from skin out all the way to the top layer. In fact, I've got an old down coat in my dry bag in the car, and it's amazing how often I've had to go to that. So I keep a dry bag in the car with enough clothes that I can take care of myself even if I get wet. All right, somebody was asking me about fishing these sinking tip lines on smallmouth bass, which is coming on here pretty soon now. The sink tip line probably is the greatest asset we've got for fishing flies deeply. Now, I'm not talking about a high D head that'll get you down 8 inches per second. I'm talking about Scientific Angler sink tip 3, sinks probably 2 to 4 inches per second, and it'll comfortably let you fish down to about 5 feet deep, unless the water is real, real fast. Is the pickup a problem? Well, not really. You can almost pick up any sink tip line just like you would a floating line. If you have a little trouble with that, use a roll cast pickup. Start it back toward you just like you're going to make the back cast. I'm doing this right at my desk. It's coming back toward me. To make the roll cast pickup, just snap that back out. That pulls the head out of the water. Zap, go ahead with your forward cast. So a sinking tip line is a tremendously nice line to use on smallmouth. Okay, hatch charts. All right, let me talk a little bit about that. We talked about making them coincide with the wildflowers. In the book I've written, Trout Fishing in Shenandoah National Book, Shenandoah National Park, and also the book I've written, Virginia Blue Ribbon Streams, I have the hatch charts in there. Art Flick helped me put all this together. We put a tremendous amount of work in there. I was sending flies back and forth to Art, and we had a big time, became very close friends. But there are hatch charts in there that show when the flies come off, what flies we use to match them, both in the nymph and the streamer, and they run throughout the major season. Now, I used to fish with old Charlie Brooks out west, and Brooks said, oh, you all have got so many flies back east, you really get confused with it. Well, actually, we don't. Most of the freestone streams, and even the spring creeks, here in the East Coast, you'll have maybe a half a dozen major hatches. And knowing when they're coming off, what flies to use, and how to fish them, they were way ahead of the game. And it'll also, just going by those hatch charts, it'll tell you what flies to have with you. All right, I'm going down my list that you're sending me. Oh, spotting trout in the stream. Yes, that's one of my favorite ways to play it. When I come into the lower end of a pool, once these streams get down just a little bit beyond where they are now, in addition to trying to spot rising trout, I always look real closely to see if I can spot trout on their feeding station. Now, I'm not talking about that guy that you spooked that's hunkering to the stream bottom hoping you don't step on him. I'm talking about a trout that is out there on his feeding station. Now, what are you looking for? How are you going to see that guy? When you move into the lower end of the pool, using polarized glasses, a dark brim hat, scan the pool very carefully. Seldom will you have the real clear view of the whole trout lying there in front of you. Rather, you'll have little things I call targets. You'll look out there and you'll see something that attracts your attention to a specific location. Closer scrutiny, very close study of that spot, and there's your trout. One of the easiest targets to locate on a trout out in the pool is his movement. Now, he may move slightly to relocate his feeding station, maybe just 6-8 inches. He may turn slightly to the side to take a nymph. Now, I'm talking about the fish underwater now. I'm not talking about those you're coming up to. He may turn to take a nymph. He may relocate on that feeding station. But that movement is the easiest thing to locate to help you find a trout. Then once you know where that guy is, then you can go one-on-one with him. Another easy thing to locate on a sunny day, if the sun is low behind you, often that shadow of the trout on the stream bottom is much, much easier to see than the trout itself. In fact, I've gotten screwed up a couple times, end up fishing for the shadow, but I know you won't do that. But anyway, the shadow that focused on the bottom of the stream is much easier to see in many cases. Contrast, for instance, if you're in a brook trout stream, brook trout have a square tail, up and straight, up and down. In fact, up in Quebec, a lot of times they would call them square tails when we were fishing up there a whole lot for them. If you're sneaking up a stream and you look down there and here you've got cobblestones on there the size of a basketball, volleyball, and they all have a roundish texture to them, and all of a sudden you see a straight edge. What in the world is that? It sure isn't that part of that volleyball-sized boulder. That might be the straight edge of a brook trout's tail. So look real closely, and there he is. Color contrast. If you're into a rainbow stream, you've got brightly colored rainbows holding over sort of a tannish, sandy bottom. That color will really let you spot the trout. So spotting them on the feeding station, I think, is an excellent way to go. Now, I had this happen firsthand. I keep an extra pair of glasses. I wear prescription glasses. I keep an extra pair in the glove compartment of my car just in case. I was doing a school in a mountain trout stream. A friend of mine had lost his, he fell in the stream, lost his glasses. He was from Richmond. If he's hearing that, he'll know what I'm talking about. He fell in the stream, lost his glasses in the stream. We looked for an hour and never could find them. Fortunately, there were two other boys there from Richmond in another car. One of those boys drove him back to Richmond. The other boy took a second car, and he was able to get home and make a safe trip out of it. So I always carry extra glasses. All right. People ask me whether I use a needle knot or do I go loop-de-loop on connecting my leader to my line. I can tell you what I do, and then I'm going to tell you why I do it. On loop-de-loop, good lines now, like the SA lines now that I use on my bass fishing, they have a welded loop built into it. I go loop-de-loop on that because I'm using a number 7 line. That'll slide through the guides pretty easily. On my trout outfits, I'm using 3-weight outfits. I do not use loop-de-loop on that because I don't like the way they bump back and forth through the guides. I go to a needle knot on that, and it'll slide back and forth through that. I have some customers that are just strictly trout fishing, some from many states away. One boy from Boston, for instance, every time he buys a trout outfit, he'll say, "Now, Harry, cut that loop off and put a needle knot on there, because I want that thing to slide through the guy just as easily as you can." So on all my trout outfits, and even my six weight in Montana, I go needle knot and put it on there. Now, I do coat it with three very, very thin layers of ply bond cement, because I just am more comfortable with the way a needle knot slides through the guides on that. Let me see what else I've got. Well, that's gotten me down to the end of the list of the things you've asked me to talk about this month. If you have any questions on any of this, just drop me a note or give me a call, and I'll be glad to talk about it. We usually do this about the middle of each month. So if you have any questions, call me at 540-984-4212. That's Murray's Fly Shop in Edinburgh, Virginia. Thank you very much.